Star Trek 57, M23, take two.
It's got Star Trek, episode 37. The Lower Decks Pilot, Second Contact.
Welcome to the holodeck. Easily the best part of the ship.
The warp core is the best part of the ship, followed by the fridge, the photon torpedo tubes, cetacean ops.
Dude, the warp core is just a big glowing tube.
I love the warp core. The warp core rules.
No, it doesn't. Computer, find us a beach in Hawaii.
What is this? This stuff is crazy. What does it do?
It just gets everywhere and gives you a rash.
You get a rash from sand?
What, you don't?
No, nobody does.
Oh, God. I always do.
Good.
Take it for a spin.
Computer, can you put us in the Adashik Center on Orion? Wow, I never made time to go before I enlisted.
Pretty cool, right? You can go almost anywhere you can imagine. Come on, Boimler. Give it a whirl.
I don't know.
Come on. There has to be somewhere you'd love to be.
Computer, show us the warp core. Wow, amazing. What an impressive feat of engineering.
What is that, a sour sop with pulp?
No, I didn't want the sour sop. It's a guanabana con pulpa. Oh, sour sop with pulp.
Well, you were reading the Spanish side of, yeah, of the can.
It's actually much better than that.
Guanabana.
Than that. What was I had last, that other time? The Terry drink? The one that tasted kind of sour like vomit, but it was sweet.
I forget. Did you like it?
It had like little bits of stuff in it.
No. It just like some kind of brown looking root thing that tasted like a sweet thing.
Hmm. Oh, tamarind.
Tamarind. Yeah. I don't know if I like that because it tastes sweet, but it also tastes like vomit.
It's a funny flavor. Yeah.
Yeah. But this is good. This actually has pulpa. So
pulpa.
Pulpa's good. That's what you want.
But these holes aren't big enough to get the chunks out of.
Yeah, you got to cut the can open, and then you can fish out the chunks.
They need to make it like a wide mouth, like they did with beer, but they don't do that.
Wide mouth.
It's green, I think. It's hard to tell when it's in a can, but I think it's green. It looks green.
You could just tear that can right in half.
That's unlike Romulan ale that's blue.
Yeah, it was Romulan whiskey.
Or whiskey, sorry.
Which is a thing I hadn't heard of before. I'd heard of Romulan ale for most of the Star Trek.
Yeah. That's a good point.
Dealio.
Okay, and that makes me think, what color is Romulan ale?
Romulan ale is also blue.
It's all blue.
So
why did Mariner think it was going to be green?
I actually find that very interesting, the Romulan ale versus Romulan whiskey, because it's a small little thing, but given how much attention this show has paid to, canon references and Easter eggs and things like that, it doesn't seem like they would have gotten that wrong.
Right.
So it seems to be purposeful in some way, maybe just to agitate the less forgiving portion of the Star Trek fandom.
Well, yeah,
seems to be quite a large section.
It made a lot of references to all things Star Trek. I don't know what we're getting into now. I'm not sure. We've never done the no spoiler thing at the beginning before, so I don't really know how to do that.
So I'll talk about that. So first of all, welcome to the It's Got Star Trek podcast. This is our first, this is our 37th episode, but the first episode discussing Star Trek Lower Decks, because the first episode just aired. But this is a bit unusual because normally we rely on our listeners to have had an opportunity to see the show, but a significant proportion of our listenership is international. And right now, the international folks can't access it, at least can't access it easily or in a quote-unquote above-board fashion. So that's going to limit the opportunities for people outside of North America to be able to see the show. So what we're going to do is we'll just have a brief section at the beginning of each episode where we just do some generic non-spoiler reactions, and then we'll warn you before we go into the full-on spoiler section when we're going to start discussing the plot and the characters in more detail.
So internationally, they don't have CBS All Access, but they have Discovery on Netflix, right? Isn't that the deal? So how does that equate to, do we know when they'll be able to get the Lower Decks?
It's on something.
The issue has been, this has driven a lot of people, this has driven a lot of people crazy because obviously folks have been waiting for the show and they want to see it. And what I've been able to gather from comments from Mike McMahon and some of the other producers and actors is that the show was originally not, it was moved up. The premiere was moved up. It was supposed to premiere later. And the implication is that the original plan was to have Discovery air and then Lower Decks follow immediately after Discovery. But the problem was is that COVID-19 struck and the lockdown and all that. And as a result of that, the post-production on Discovery slowed down.
Yeah, I was going to say it's unusual for something to release early because of COVID, but this is because it's animated, so it's already precisely all kind of done.
And not only that, it was the production was able to continue. Whatever post-production, whatever final production they needed to do on Lower Decks was able to continue at a more normal rate compared to Discovery, which their post-production has continued, but for example, they've had to record the musical score at home, basically, complicated setups. And the special effects have had to be done in a not as unified way. So they're getting it done, but it's taking longer than they expected. So they made this last minute switch, and that resulted in my understanding is two problems. One problem was that the international distribution deals for Lower Decks were not yet complete.
Oh, yeah.
Right? So they were, I think, still in the process of negotiating those. I don't know where they stand at the moment, but clearly that played into it in terms of not having an international release date. They've moved the show up by 3 or 4 months, so they just figured they had more time to figure that out. And part and parcel of that is that to have an international release, they need to do the foreign language or local language, I should say, dubbing and subtitles, right? That's a whole process. I believe it's tied into the contracts for the international distribution and all that. So, you know, that takes time to do for every episode.
Right. So this makes a lot of sense, knowing that it was originally intended to, they were going to release Discovery, and then after they aired all the Discovery, they were going to release Lower Decks. And this makes much more sense now that we know that it got sort of sped up.
So I think that I'm pretty confident that they're going to release it internationally fairly soon. That's certainly the word you hear from the producers. The question is, are they going to release it piecemeal, region by region, sort of as they complete the work and get the contracts negotiated? Or are they going to wait for a bigger, you know, international splash? I don't know. Hopefully folks will be able to watch this show soon. I'm sure soon enough you'll be able to watch it. But in the intervening time, you know, we want people to still be able to enjoy the show a little bit without being unnecessarily spoiled. And I think it's perfectly reasonable to provide some generic reactions to each episode.
I think we're charming enough. We can pull something.
Yeah, I mean, especially Jesse's.
Then we can start.
Charming.
Then we'll start talking about stuff, and we'll just say, "Hey, listen to something else."
So the Discovery, like you were saying, they had to do the music at home, and they had to.
Are they using an orchestra?
Yeah,
I mean, they had to. You said bummer
yeah.
that they're using an orchestra.
Yeah, I guess it's a union thing. But like, if in this situation is when you just like start using like computers and stuff.
Oh, you're saying
instead of having everybody like record like remotely from our house. Like,
yeah,
or have to wait until they can meet in person. I don't know if they're what they're doing, but
and if they're doing that, if they're doing the special effects, you said kind of like. In inconsistent ways, I wonder how that's going to affect the production in terms of what the viewer sees, because there have been writer strikes in the past, and I didn't necessarily notice it at the time, but I might have thought, wow, that was a weird season, and then later on I find out it was a writer strike.
Yeah, it'll be interesting to see if it affects the final product. In all likelihood not. That's probably why they're delaying the show, because they want to make sure that it doesn't. So, but anyway, that explains the whole situation with Lower Decks, why it doesn't have an international release, but hopefully will do soon. So, what did you think of the pilot episode of this show? It's always a tricky thing. A new show, a new set of characters, new style in this case, a very significant departure. What were your thoughts?
I thought it was good.
I enjoyed it. I was entertained by the episode. So all I can say is for that one episode, I was definitely entertained. I never kind of like went, too bad or anything. Like,
yeah.
I think when I saw the trailer, the one thing that made me wonder is when she sliced into his leg with that bat lift. I was kind of like, wait a minute, what? But it's not a big.
That's not a spoiler because it was in the trailer.
It was in the trailer. Oh. Yeah. So I was like wondering like how wacky and crazy is this going to be? I don't know. But it turns out it wasn't it like it all was cohesive and it all made it feel like Star Trek and it all made me when I was watching it I was like, this is Star Trek. It's like it's wacky and off the wall and stuff like that, but it still feels like Star Trek. And I was entertained and I never rolled my eyes. I'm sure there's plenty of people that were like, oh, that part was so cringe. I didn't get that feeling.
I didn't get much cringe during the show at all, really. And this show, it makes me want to see more. I definitely want to see more of this show, but I definitely liked it. I wasn't like, you know, it seems like they got a lot of mixed reviews and some people were like, oh, this is kind of weak and flat.
Yes.
And it's just a bunch of Star Trek references. And I was like, well, that's kind of what's cool about it.
So, and I'm just, you know, I'm coming from a perspective. I haven't read any of the reviews or,
I read a handful.
I'm going to read reviews, but I kind of like just until I was kind of holding off for a little bit to read the views, and then I will. But I think I saw a headline. The only headline I saw was through Google, and it was from, I guess it was like some kind of indie website. Maybe it was IndieWire or something. And the headline was basically like, this is some of the purest Star Trek. So it was like a positive note.
Most of it.
And that was just the headline. But I know if I look into it, because I've played like, there's this video game, Borderlands 2, and I think it's really funny. And then, you know, there's a lot of people think it's funny, but then a lot of people are also like, oh, it's total cringe. They use that word a lot. Mm-hmm. And it's like, not funny, total cringe. I hated it. You know, I didn't laugh once. And like, okay, fine. That's fine.
So you don't have to play it. That's awesome.
Right. Yeah, exactly. So I'm open to the idea that there'll be a lot of people who probably consider this show, you know, they probably have the same reaction. And who knows how honest they're being versus how much they want to preempt their enjoyment of it somehow. I don't know. But, you know, to each their own on that one. So that's what, but I saw a lot of sort of like with Borderlands, there's sort of like a lot of sort of like, you know, wacky kind of humor. And I know the same humor isn't for everybody. So
the issue is the internet and humanity, because there were so many people before this show aired just declaring what it would be.
Yeah.
And,
right.
And much as granted, we've only seen this one episode, and I know we're still in the non-spoiler section, so we won't go into details, but we can say that a lot of what you saw in the trailer was certainly out of context or misleading. I mean, as Jesse was saying, when taken as a whole, it worked very, very well. And humor is always, as we discussed last week on our episode just on humor and Star Trek more generally, humor is subjective. It's one of the more subjective things out there. You can analyze it all you want, like when Bobby Hill went to community college to learn about humor. But this show is not going to be for everybody, right? But that's okay. It's not supposed to be. But I was thoroughly entertained. I thought it was really fun. I thought, you know, when you compare it to a lot of Star Trek pilots, it's a pretty strong pilot in how quickly, within the span of about 22 minutes, introduces you to these the four main characters, of course, the Lower Decks people, and as well as to the rest of the crew, puts them through a very, very Star Trek style story, right? And has a lot of character and some philosophical stuff going on in there, along with some wacky, you know, being able to portray aliens in a more creative way than live action Star Trek usually can. And the thing is, Mike McMahon, the creator of the show, he was one of the top writers over at Rick and Morty. And a lot of people love Rick and Morty. A lot of people can't stand it or are indifferent to it. If you're worried that this is Rick and Morty, it's not. This is a totally, you could.
Yeah, not at all.
It shares with Rick and Morty is a multi-layered, rapid-fire sense of humor, where there's just jokes layered upon jokes and background jokes and things. There's the humor is dense. The storytelling is dense and multi-layered. So it has that a little bit in common with Rick and Morty. And it has in common the fact that the people writing the show clearly have an incredibly in-depth knowledge of both Star Trek specifically and sci-fi more generally. So There's that commonality, but it's not, it's a very different tone, very different style of storytelling. This is Star Trek style storytelling, A and B story, you know, it's a proper star, it's the Star Trek format. Even the way the show is directed is more static cameras, you know, like TNG or the Orville, you know, with like slow pans and zooms and things. It's not
the,
as
the credits and the opening sequence is all, you know, just like any other Star Trek show.
Yeah. So,
hey, you better put on your shoe, Mon, to do some slow pans.
I don't get it.
It's like Schumann and Chopin.
I will say, you know,
Chopin list.
I will say that I do think the 22 minutes you feel the format. You feel that it's 22 minutes long in positive.
What's funny about the things that are that length is it says 26 minutes, but the last 4 minutes have taken up by all other stuff. But I'm like, 26 minutes. This is an extra long one. I was like, oh, it's 22 minutes. But it's true. They talk about how like they have to trim like seconds out of like these shows, and
to get it right there.
And it's fucking like torturous for them to have to like.
I can imagine.
Yeah.
We talked about this with the animated series, the original animated series for Star Trek, where you can take this Star Trek story and you can see where they slice stuff out that would have been in a normal show. So in other words, maybe it would have taken longer to resolve this scientific question or to negotiate this or that. You know, you could see where in a normal show it would have been given more time to breathe. It would have been a bit of a calmer presentation. The animated series had that, and at least in terms of the first episode here, this has that too. Now, that's not a positive or a negative, but it is a difference. You can feel the sort of more compressed, contracted form of storytelling.
Versus their regular, like, what we think of as a typical Star Trek.
Length. Yeah, if you think it was about almost twice the length, you know, that there's more room for the story to breathe. Now, that can actually be a drawback too. Some stories are only only worth 20, 30 minutes, and they stretch them out. Others, they kind of squeeze them in, so...
Speaking of, you know, sort of condensing things, and I think you mentioned something about how, you know, it's this, the Lower Decks is, by the way, Lower Decks, not easy to look up at this point on Google. Because
you gotta say just, Star Trek Lower Decks.
But then it just takes you to the fucking episode of TNG.
Yes, you gotta get past that.
Yeah.
The Google SEO demons will figure that out.
They'll figure that out. Yeah, I'll give them some time. They deserve, they earned it. But you're talking about how the Lower Decks is kind of some like a lot of references and sort of like rapid fire and those kinds of humor. That's tricky because like a lot of shows can do it, and then shows it can start to sound like just like redundant and just I was just like, okay, how many of these can you shove in there? I get it. Simpsons is what nowadays. Simpsons used to be. I mean, Simpsons is an amazing show. I'll just say Simpsons is an amazing show. It used to be like my favorite show to watch. I haven't watched it in years. A lot of other people feel similarly. It's just not the same. Yeah. Not even just the same. It just doesn't, the vibe is different, but they sort of push in all these references. Mm-hmm. And before they would do that, but it was smooth. And this way it was just like, it was like in your face. And it's just kind of like, it feels like they have a quota to meet or something in terms of references for something like that.
They're trying to keep up with Family Guy or something.
Yeah. Yeah. Right. And so, okay. So Simpsons, it doesn't work. Family Guy, for whatever reason,
it's founded on that concept.
Yeah. Yeah. It works.
It's core to the concept.
It is. And so, yeah, it wasn't something that was sort of tried to wrap around another thing. It was its own. That's how it began. So it had a proper foundation in that sense, if that's what it was going for. So that works. You know, interestingly, I was talking about Borderlands. A lot of people thought that kind of had the same thing going on with all these references. I happen to like it. This one was tricky. Real quick, the Napoleon Dynamite cartoon. That was...
this is the second time you've brought that cartoon up.
Whatever, I brought that up on air before.
I brought it up. A few episodes ago.
Okay, yeah. I knew I brought it up. I just couldn't remember where. Anyways, yeah, Jared. I think Jared Hess is the name. I think he's like... I think it's all the same people, but it just doesn't work because it's just things don't flow right. And so I understand that these sort of jokes that they're throwing in the Lower Decks, they kind of might have that same vibe that they're just kind of throwing them in there. For whatever reason, I enjoyed it, and I'm trying to figure out why that is.
Because you like Star Trek,
yeah.
This is giving you.
I like Napoleon Dynamite too, but like I don't. Yeah. I really can't compare them.
I mean, I haven't seen the Napoleon Dynamite one, but I would suggest that this was competently produced.
Yeah.
I mean, I think that's part of it. I mean, the pedigree of the writers
is so tricky.
Yeah, well, that's the thing is the writers, the actors, the voice actors, and we're going to go over that soon. We're going to talk more about the characters in depth in the spoiler section, but the just the production of it was just very well done. And I found that, you know, for those wondering, yeah, there's tons of references. Some of them are overt. There's a lot of Easter eggs, but there's tons of references to the Star Trek universe. And there are a couple you might argue are a little bit in your face, but it's also a pilot episode and they're, you know, you can forgive them a little bit. And honestly, for the rest of them, they're not. So if they feel in your face, it's only because you're looking out for them. Because when you look at other shows, I mean, forget about Discovery and Picard. I'm talking about Enterprise and Voyager and Deep Space Nine. The amount of references they laid down from what came before was extreme. They were, that's one reason why we enjoy those shows so much, because of the world building of the Star Trek universe. And once TNG got along a little bit, that's when they started to take it more seriously. You know, TOS, TAS, and early TNG kind of played fast and loose with the whole canon and references and stuff. But then it started to congeal into this nice growing universe, which is growing to this day.
You know, people become approaching Lower Decks from a standpoint where it's like, I'm watching a comedic show, you know, this is a funny take on Star Trek or whatever. So when people, I think it's possible that when people like hear these Easter eggs, they're coming from it from a different context. So maybe it must be like, oh, they're just like joking about everything in this show. Like, they just bring up things and, you know,
it's a comedy show.
Yeah. And so, but you can do that, like you said, in like TNG, because it's like more of serious, it's more a continuation of the world. I think maybe people get concerned that because they're coming from it from a different angle, they're coming from it from a different sort of comedic expectation, their assumption might be like, oh, they're just throwing in a joke there, which they are a lot of times. I don't know where I was really going with that, but the point is
you might be saying the same thing. You know, you might be taking the long road to saying what TrekMovie.com in their review, they said, this is funny Star Trek. It's not making fun of Star Trek.
Yeah. Right?
They managed to do that.
That's a really good way of putting it.
Yeah,
actually,
well, they're professional writers, and we're fucking
thought
assholes.
About that. Yeah, right. Like, no, that like I was like, oh yeah, I don't have to talk about that anymore. I know what.
We'll wrap up the non-spoiler section because we'll want to get into some of the meat now. But I thought we'd finish this up with a comment from a regular listener, Tarek, who I think probably is going to encapsulate the views of a fair number of people. Certainly encapsulated, you know, certainly represents my viewpoint very well. He said, overall, I was pleasantly surprised and enjoyed it. This honestly surprised me since I never got into Rick and Morty. It was like playing a remastered video game. I get the new style, in this case the animation, but there's enough familiar bits, design of ship, rooms, uniforms, to make me have that nostalgic feeling. I thought the voice cast was very good and can't wait to see how the stories evolve throughout the season. There were a few moments where I did kind of get thrown out of it. Some of that might be the 30-minute length versus 1 hour I'm used to. But everything has rough spots at first. Looking forward to 9 more weeks of it and reading all the whiny folks online complain about it. So, now, I come from I'm a big Rick and Morty fan, so that's the only difference I have with Tarek there. But I agree. And the other point I wanted to make is all the stuff I'm hearing about the Lower Decks sounds almost exactly to what we were hearing about the Orville before the Orville premiered. Everyone's saying, oh, Seth MacFarlane, make it funny. They're making fun of Star Trek, blah, blah, blah. And rapidly people decided, no, the Orville is almost a rebirth of Star Trek. It was not what people expected. Some of that was the marketing, to be fair to those folks, but some of it was just their preconceptions about somebody like Seth MacFarlane, where I think he's the kind of person that can demonstrate, just because he does one thing over here doesn't mean you shouldn't give him a chance over on this other side, because he's interested in doing something different, and with the Orville he did. And I, you know, preliminary, you know, based off of one episode so far, I'd say Lower Decks, same conclusion thus far, that they're trying something different, and so far it seems to be competent and interesting, and it has opportunities to grow in some really cool directions.
Kind of on a tangent, when you were talking about Orville, have you ever like read like those top 10 or top 5, you know, everyone's read those. Well, I'm at some stupid lead in. Okay. Have you ever read any of the Star Trek ones that are like top 5 Star Trek movies or whatever?
Sure.
Have you ever read one that has like in the number two spot, Galaxy Quest.
Yes. They always put Galaxy Quest.
Right. So I just got thinking about that when you were talking about the Orville and how that's kind of like really feels like this great, you know, I don't even know if you call it an homage to Star Trek. I don't know what you call it.
I think you do. And I think Galaxy Quest qualifies as well, where even though they were, like, Galaxy Quest was going more for straight comedy, but it had serious moments. That's what surprised
people. Is that the one with Tim Allen?
Yeah, it's with Tim Allen. You know, he was an
Alan Rickman
cocaine dealer and went to jail and he ratted out his friends.
Yeah.
And got out of jail as a result. He wrote a book
called Don't Stand Too Close to a Naked Man. I read it in an airport once.
You read the book in an airport or just the cover?
Oh, well, I brought the book onto the plane.
You're being very noncommittal with this reading. Dan can read. I can vouch for the fact that Dan can read.
I read the whole thing, though. Yes, I got through it.
I don't know if it was a short book or a long flight.
Ah.
Oh. That's some British style
of
humor.
Hey, why don't you go take a long walk off a short pier?
That's all right. An American style joke.
So why don't we, are we cool now? Let's go into the spoiler zone.
Let's go into the spoiler zone.
Anybody who does not want to be spoiled for the first episode because you haven't seen it or stolen it or whatever, that signal from Dan's device indicates that we are now entering the spoiler zone. You've been dutifully warned. You have no excuses after this point. Spoilers are forthcoming. All right, now that we got rid of those jabronis, let's talk about the good shit.
What a transition. Fuck those guys from before. Seriously, I hope they're all gone.
Which guys are we talking about?
The ones, the
poor underprivileged souls who don't currently have access to the television show.
Yeah. Everybody that doesn't live in America.
You do know some of them are going to continue listening because they'll be like, fuck it, I don't care. I want to hear about it.
It doesn't matter.
Oh, I don't care. I don't mind being spoiled.
Nothing matters anymore.
Oh, man. I'm just kidding, you guys.
Dirt and darkness.
All right. So,
dirt and darkness. I thought, jeez. Everything's just dirt and darkness.
Sounds kind of funny when you say it.
Because it's an alliteration.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. All right. I thought, like, before, like, we'll go through the what happened in the episode. A lot of stuff happened in that compressed amount of time. But I figured, real quick, we'll just go through the characters, the main group of characters we were introduced to, and the actors. You know, since this is a pilot episode, talk a little bit about that. So first, we have Ensign Beckett Mariner.
What's a pilot?
Who is played by Tawny Newsom. And people might know her from Bajillion Dollar Properties. Recently, she was on Space Force.
Yeah.
Brockmire.
Oh, that's why I recognize her voice.
And she's on Comedy Bang Bang podcast a lot.
I was actually thinking of her from Space Force, and I didn't know that that was her, but I was like, huh.
Now you know.
Wow.
But so she's cool. I mean, you know, Bajillion Dollar Properties, for folks who haven't seen it, I know it's unfortunately, not a lot of people sell Bajillion Dollar Properties. I think there's four seasons. Find it if you can. It's great.
It looks interesting.
It's a spoof show about, you know, it's like one of those reality shows about selling houses, except it's a fictional version.
That sounds pretty good, actually.
All the actors are great. The storylines are fantastic. It's absurdist humor. It's great, but she's really good in it. So I knew her from that.
People in my family are always watching those, like, fix up the house, sell it shows, or this is, you want to move in here? We'll fix it up for you.
I like the style of those shows, but I get mad at them because they're so fake and horrible. That's why Bajillion Dollar Properties works, because it's filmed in exactly that style and it takes it to the extreme absurdities.
I think I got obsessed with that Pawn Star show for a short while. And then I was like, wait a minute. This is all the same shit every day.
It's not even their pawn shop. It's some pawn shop that's rented out for the day for filming. And they just bring products in and make it. It's all made up. Yeah, like, those aren't actual customers.
Yeah, they call ahead of time and they like work out the deal and what's going to happen, or maybe they were a customer and they fucking already made the sale. That's what happens
with those house selling shows where they say you're going to pick between these three houses. They've already bought the house.
Yeah, right.
And they call up their friends and neighbors and have them pretend that their house is on sale to have the cameras go through, and they'll be like, "Oh, I don't like the bathroom." So we're going to go with this house. It's all rigged, which is no problem. It's entertainment. It's a little unfortunate that I think fewer people understand that how fictionalized those are to begin with. But again, that's why Bajillion Dollar Properties works, because it takes it and puts it in your face, the sort of fictional nature of that whole enterprise. Then Ensign Brad Boimler And I'm guessing that there's going to be this running joke of calling him bumfuck or butthole.
Bumboiler.
Or whatever.
Oh, yeah, right. They're going to keep getting his name. Yeah.
Well, what did you... I forget.
Because the captain called him something.
Bumfeld.
Yeah.
She called him
Bumfeld.
Yeah. Broomley. Ensign Broomley.
Bumlord.
Charles Quigley.
It'll be like on Good Times when like they kept calling the super by like a different name.
Yeah.
It was always like Booger and Buttman. And...
yeah. Good Times is a great show.
I know. I should have called it Great Times.
Ensign Brad Boimler, he's played by Jack Quaid, who most people probably most recently know him from The Boys on Amazon. He plays the sort of the guy whose girlfriend gets killed by a superhero, which sets the plot into motion. The Boys is another fantastic game.
Wait, which actor are you talking about?
Jack Quaid. He's
Meg Ryan's son, so he looks like Meg Ryan.
Is he related to that? Randy
he's also
Quaid?
He's Dennis Quaid's
Dennis
son.
Who's related to Randy Quaid, right?
That's right. I knew he was Dennis Quaid's son. Yeah. Well, he was in Hunger Games. He was in Logan Lucky.
Yeah,
but The Boys, I think, is his big, probably a lot of folks will know him from. So he's really good.
Jack Quaid.
Ensign Devana Tendi. She's the Orion ensign who serves sort of as the audience surrogate.
I know this actor from somewhere.
I think she's from Saturday Night Live.
Yeah, Noelle. Devana Tendi's played by Noelle Wells. She was on Master of None and a few other things. She's a bit more of an up and comer, I think. I think she's done a lot, but you know. Her IMDb is a little bit shorter, so this is, you know, I'm very interested to see where they go with her character. Ensign Sam Rutherford is played by Eugene Cordero, who is on everything. I mean, he's a face that you'll...
Looks like he was on that bajillion.
He was on Bajillion Dollar Properties, Bob's Burgers, The Mandalorian, Archer, Veep. He played a continuing role, Brooklyn Nine-Nine.
Oh, wait, who was he on Veep?
I don't know because I didn't see Veep yet, but
I keep meaning to see that.
Son of Zorn, Dan. That was Son of Zorn.
One of my favorites.
He shows up a lot on Comedy Bang Bang, Parks and Recreation, Key and Peele, Silicon Valley, Arrested Development. I think he comes out of Upright Citizens Brigade.
Right.
He was also on The Good Place.
I'm gonna have to get a IMDb picture of this fellow.
Oh, Eugene Cordero, you would totally recognize.
Jesse,
he's a very recognizable
Wikipedia's not
dude.
Giving me a picture.
Jesse, you ever see that Son of Zorn show?
No.
Oh man, I highly recommend it. But you'll just be sad that you're like the whole time you're gonna know that it got canceled after one season. But it was something.
Son of Zorn.
It was like He-Man meets, you know, today's TV shows or something. I don't know. That wasn't a very good description. I didn't really my elevator pitch and work on a bit.
Oh, okay, I've seen this fellow.
Then you have Chief Medical Officer Ta'ana, who's a Cation. She's a cat person who we last saw in the animated series, at least in the on-screen. So,
she's
like
a crazy Cation.
They might have had somebody in, like, I don't know, background of Star Trek 3 or something like that. But really, we haven't seen the Cation since the animated series.
I'm still trying to figure out where I've seen Jack Quaid from, because, like, I recognize this guy.
You watched him in The Boys.
He looks like Meg Ryan. You've seen Meg Ryan.
Gillian Vigman plays Medical Officer Ta'ana.
Yeah.
And she was in all three Hangover movies, Step Brothers, The 40-Year-Old Virgin.
Step Brothers.
So, you know, if you look her up, you'd recognize her.
Look her up.
Then you have First Officer Commander Jack Ransom, played
Ransom.
By Jerry O'Connell.
Jerry O'Connell.
Yes.
Who, of course, his three most prominent things are Stand By Me, Sliders, and Kangaroo Jack.
Sliders, a show that I've seen the most of but never seen at all.
Sliders is a weird one because I watched Sliders. I've
never seen an episode of Sliders.
Oh, I watched Sliders in the 90s along with Time Tracks. And
did you watch Stargate?
I watched Stargate, the original Stargate I watched.
Well, the movie, yeah. But
No, the TV show.
Oh, the TV show?
Yeah,
was there two TV shows? Oh, was
yeah,
oh, really?
There was like three TV shows.
Oh, I didn't fucking know that. That's how little I know about Stargate.
Yeah, there was Stargate Atlantis, and then there was some other one.
Oh, that's right. There was a bunch of that.
I tried to get into that Xena and Hercules stuff or whatever, but I could never get into those
shows. I wasn't
shows.
Into Hercules.
Xena
enjoyed.
Xena was good, yeah.
But Xena's similar
Hercules
to...
Hercules had something, Kevin Sorbo.
Yeah.
That's right.
But
sure
he turned into a fucking asshole by all accounts.
Did he? What did he do?
I think he's an asshole.
Oh, man.
You know.
Like classic today kind of asshole?
Today style asshole.
Okay.
You know what I'm saying?
I know what you're saying.
But Sliders
sort of
is a
red,
show.
Red hat.
Xena's the same. I don't remember any episode. I don't remember them. I watched them, and I don't understand because
they were
all
kind of the same, but it was still good.
I remember fucking episodes of Small Wonder, which was a worse show.
So does Dan Glover.
But I remember when she got pot from the local dealer in the school, and she hid it at home under the potted plant, like in the pot, but picked up.
Are you
the
talking
plant.
About the robot girl?
Yeah, the robot girl. She put the weed under the dirt with the plant in it. She put the plant back on top of the pot, but she didn't put it in all the way. She's a fucking robot, and she didn't notice that it wasn't in all the way.
Can you imagine being that brother and being like, "Oh, I have a robot sister now that my parents pay much more attention to."
Yeah, I wasn't good enough.
She's
they had to
this
make
is
someone
crucial stuff.
This is crucial.
I am Vicky. I am high.
This is 1980s, early 90s marijuana. It is insufficient for my intoxication program.
What was it? What Wheaton say? Is this like being drunk? It feels good.
Yeah,
fun or something.
I feel strange, but also good.
Yeah,
something along those lines.
We just talked about this last week.
Yeah. Captain Carol Freeman is played by Dawn Lewis, and Dawn Lewis is
a different world.
She was on a different world. She was Jaleesa on a different world. I'm gonna get you, sucker. Dreamgirls. She's done a lot of voice work. Futurama, old Spider-Man cartoons.
Spider-Man.
She was in The Cherokee Kid with Sinbad.
Well,
I remember seeing a poster
Sinbad
for
Sinbad was
that
on a
film.
Different world.
Yeah, Sinbad was, he was cool on a different world.
He made that show.
You know what's crazy?
She was also on Rick and Morty, by the way. Dawn Lewis played she was on one episode of Rick and Morty as an alien.
Crazy is
this better be fucking crazy.
That what's her name from that? What's her name from that Girls in the City show?
Are you talking about Sex in the City? No, I just failed off the first sentence. Are you talking about Caroline in the City or Sex
up
in the
City? First sentence. This better be good. I'm like, you know that.
Are you talking about Leah Thomas?
Are you talking about Girls? The show Girls?
No, the one where there's those two girls in the New York. It's modern day, and they smoke weed and stuff.
I know the
you
show
gotta
you're
narrow
talking
it down,
about.
Dude.
The City Girls.
Yeah,
it sounds like a show I don't watch, but maybe I should watch it.
It's that show called, oh my God, I used to watch this show a lot. Now I'm freaking out.
Is there a Silverman show?
No, it's like these two girls and they're in the city. And they like smoke weed
and
stuff.
You gotta narrow it down, dude. That's like every show. It's like two girls in a city, dude.
Smoking weed. No. Yeah. So, but they get into all sorts of shenanigans.
I don't know if
Laverne
I should put
and
Dan out of
no,
his misery.
No, it's modern.
Modern.
I found it. You know what I typed in? You know what I typed in search?
Girls smoking weed.
I wrote two girls in city, Hulu. It's called Broad City.
Oh, yeah, Broad City.
Broad City.
Yeah. Okay. They're using an anachronistic term for a woman, broad.
Right.
Which also means has breadth and also, you know.
If they called
wide.
It Tomato Town, nobody would understand what it was.
Right. Yeah, that's exactly.
I'm down to clown into Tomato Town.
So what I was saying is, so Abby Jacobson.
Yeah, this is going to be the crazy thing, right?
Yeah, this is crazy. Abby Jacobson is in Broad City, okay?
Mm-hmm. I've heard of that person.
Yes. Okay. Yeah, we've gotten to that. We've gotten to this stage. We've
the name
this
of the
stage,
show is called Broad City.
This stage
and
of the anecdote.
And she's in that show with Hannibal Buress.
Hannibal Buress, yeah.
Whatever.
He brought down Cosby.
Buress. Oh, Hannibal Buress.
He's a good man.
So Abby Jacobson and Hannibal Buress is in the show
very
Broad
funny
City.
Funny guy, too.
Abby Jacobson is in Disenchantment with Eric Andre.
Mm-hmm.
And of course, Eric Andre.
Oh, she's in Disenchantment.
Eric Andre was, of course, in the Eric Andre show with Hannibal Buress. Isn't that crazy? You were just talking about
Hollywood, baby.
They were in some other show together, and I was thinking of another example where that happened, where people are in the show, same movie. It's like they all have.
It happens a lot in Star Trek.
Are they all contracted to the same company? Is that how that works, or are they just buddies and they give each other roles? You know what I mean?
Yeah, everybody tries to work as much as they can. I think. Yeah.
All right, Lieutenant Shax is a Bajoran security officer.
Oh, he's Bajoran. Okay, I wasn't
Bajoran,
clear.
Yeah.
I wasn't clear on that.
He's Bajoran. He's got the earring. Got the the wrinkly nose.
If I was more astute.
Fred Tatasciore.
Tatasaurus?
I wish I could pronounce his name right. He is an old school, he's been doing voiceover acting since the late 80s, early 90s. And he's in everything.
Does anybody know how to read IPA?
He's in Team America. He did voice work for pretty much every huge video game you can think of, like Final Fantasy VII, and he was in Robot Chicken.
He was in VII?
Final Fantasy VII.
Oh, okay.
I knew that's what you meant.
But he's been in so much. He was in the new Voltron. I mean, he's in hundreds of things on IMDb. A lot of video games, top shelf video games, Last of Us and stuff like that. So he's a
Thundercats.
He's a proper voice actor. Next up, you have Lieutenant Commander Andy Billups, who I believe is the chief engineer. I don't know if they made that clear in this episode or not, but
they didn't.
He's played by Paul Scheer, who, of course, people will know him as well. Curb Your Enthusiasm, The Good Place, Big Mouth, American Dad, Veep. Drunk History, Brooklyn Nine-Nine, Bajillion Dollar Properties again. The League is one of the things where he probably is very well known from. Comedy Bang Bang, he's on a lot. Parks and Recreation, Wet Hot American
Summer.
Oh, that
dude, Paul Scheer. Okay.
Yeah, NTSF, SD, SUV, Human Giant, and Upright Citizens Brigade. He was in, those are the ones that he kind of came to prominence through.
In Parks and Rec, he was that guy that was all like running a prank where he pretended to be like this guy.
He tricked people
into building like playgrounds.
Yeah, he tricked people into the communities into building playgrounds and things.
Yeah, he's like driving a yacht at the end. Yeah. He's like, I'm just a rich guy and I'm an asshole and I trick people into doing community service. Paul Scheer is fantastic. He's got a number of great podcasts, including How Did This Get Made, which is about kind of bad movies or, you know, that sort of thing. He's he's a very smart, very introspective, interesting guy. They only announced his casting a few weeks ago or a month ago. So I don't know if he was a late addition or what. And what I noticed is there's basically a lot of cross-pollination between the Scott Aukerman universe of Comedy Bang Bang, Bajillion Dollar Properties, etc., and the Michael Schur universe of Parks and Rec and Brooklyn Nine-Nine, The Good Place. There seems to be those seem to be the people that are being fed into this cast is people who've come through those routes.
Keep
which is feeding, interesting
Cerritos on ship Cerritos. Cerritos, right. Docked in Douglas Station. They're looking at the capital planet, the Galar system, for the Galadonians.
Yeah.
It's a second contact mission.
Second? I thought that was pretty funny.
That's where they're like checking back in with them, and they're like...
Yeah. Hey. And it's funny, because like the captain's all like at the end trying to like talk about the importance of second contact. It's like, you don't know what stuff you can get on second contact. We got it, you know, so whatever.
I like this concept as a basis for the show, and I also like it as a jumping off point for the show to look into those things you think about Star Trek that they never address for obvious reasons or because it's just not interesting to the story. They're now able to address some of those things. Like, for example, that opening scene you referenced earlier, Dan, when Mariner, you know, slices open Boimler's leg. I always thought, I was like, okay, as medical devices and technology advances, people will presumably become more careless when it's like if you can just grow your leg back or whatever, you're not going to care. And it's like, you think about like, you know, you can start chopping off your penis or whatever, and it's not such a big deal because you just like go, you know, wave the light over
a new penis
and get a new penis or get, you know, get your old one back on.
Probably get your old one.
He was all saying like Worf.
Yeah. Why was he all saying Worf?
I don't know.
Cause she was talking about being in a prison, a Klingon prison or something.
Yeah.
Like, what was she talking about being in a,
I wonder if she was referencing Ruapente. Because, you know, Ruapente, of course, Kirk and McCoy went to Ruapente in Star Trek VI, and Archer goes to Ruapente at one point in Enterprise. I think there was another one. Was it Discovery?
They were talking about...
It was one of the J.J. Abrams movies. There was a deleted scene where they went to Ruapente.
Okay, so they were talking about... He was talking about that. They were talking. He was talking about some guy with old guy with an eye patch, and then Boimler started saying Worf, and it's like then there was a bat lift. I wasn't sure
about
if
the guy from the Undiscovered Country, right?
Well, there was that guy. Yeah. There's also General Martok.
Yeah,
and so I mean, there's a few Klingons around.
Few eye patches.
Yeah, I guess so. And I don't know why he started chanting. What did Rural Penthe have to do with him chanting Worf?
I don't know.
It just
you could argue that was just some gooblygop.
Just a few layers of Star Trek there.
Yeah. So I think they said they connected Batleth with Worf with old guy with an eye patch. I wasn't sure
It was all just Klingon. Like it was just a spew of Klingon.
It was just Klingon pop culture references.
Yeah. Yeah.
So whatever, it's fine.
It's like I'm gonna swing a Batleth at you, and like we're gonna say a bunch of Klingon stuff.
Yeah. I mean, I guess that's an opening scene, so it's kind of like getting you primed for what to expect.
And then
in retrospect, that opening scene, you know, It's fine. It's just kind of like a bunch of stuff.
This is, I think, going to be potentially an issue in this show, but maybe only in the pilot, where they've got to get a lot of information out. We've seen this in other Star Trek pilots, like in Encounter at Farpoint has some good examples where they're just sort of saying stuff to another character to explain what the show is about. It's a tricky thing when you're trying to get somebody into the show as quickly as possible, and the gimmick of him doing the pseudo captain's log.
Right. Yeah, exactly.
You know,
see, that kind of makes sense. I like when they were walking down the hall, and she was like talking to the new Tendi, and it was basically saying, "Oh, there's this room, there's some bullshit, and there's some bullshit room over there," because that's what it basically is to the viewer. It's a bullshit room off of the side. He's like, "Well, no, actually, that's a photon torpedo tubes over there. That's the cetacean ops."
And by the way, the producers in an interview said they are going to do an episode with cetacean ops in the second season. Yeah.
Right on.
They said they already have it planned.
So when he was talking about the photon torpedo access tubes or whatever and the cetacean ops, that was like, that made sense, and that was funny. I thought it was like some bullet like machine gun sort of references, but they fit into the sort of story, and it fit in as the viewer sort of like fourth wall, not really fourth wall, but kind of meta. It's just kind of like, yeah, all this shit that you don't care about normally in Star Trek, this is what it is. So
yeah,
it's kind of funny. I thought that was pretty good.
And that kind of stuff, that's all real. So you have to like really be paying attention to Star Trek to pick up on stuff about the cetaceans. Like,
yeah.
I mean, that's all like, you know, you have to be like watching the show and like reading books and stuff.
That's
like
some deep background knowledge.
There's not even a lot of that on the internet.
And what I think was an interesting choice
awesome
they made.
Bring the internet episode about it.
Yeah, that's like pre-internet stuff.
Yeah.
But what they're telling us with the structure of the show is, on the one hand, if you look at the star date, we know this is taking place in about 2380.
It's 57436.2,
which is just after Nemesis, right?
Yeah.
So we have an understanding of the time frame. Yet the design scheme of the ship, and I think the holodeck is a good example, but also the hallways and things, it's more in line with TNG style Starfleet architecture as opposed to Voyager TNG movie style, which became
it's more like the 60s.
Well, it's more like the 80s.
The 2360s.
Yeah, that's right. You motherfucker.
The 1980s, 2360s.
Precisely.
Yeah, even the deck wasn't quite as, or the bridge rather, wasn't quite as raised in the back as TNG, but it still felt like it with just like sort of a lowered.
What I think they're saying is,
I think they're saying
we are in this era that is post-Nemesis, but this particular ship is an older ship. So it's got some upgrades. It's not some terrible ship or anything. However, it is not, you know, it's not the top of the line. It's not the Enterprise E. It's not the latest and greatest with all the crazy new gray and dark gray
stuff.
It's like
a little ship. It's just one of their little like workhorse ships that just goes around and, you know, it's a ship of the line.
Fills out the forms.
Yeah.
And all that. In the holodeck, I liked the reference. Boimler was like complaining about the sand, and it made me think of Anakin Skywalker.
Yeah, because when he said it gets everywhere, I don't know if they meant it. I really don't know if they meant it.
Because
he didn't do the whole thing. He just.
Just a hint of it. And then he talks about getting a rash. He's like, doesn't everybody do it?
Yeah. I thought that too. And then she wanted to go to, Tendi wanted to go to her home planet, which was, I don't remember.
She's from Orion.
She's from Orion, yeah.
And Orion.
That's
and
why she's green.
And it was some place in Orion where she, Adashaki Center or something? Adashaki?
Is that where Pike's hanging out in that
It's on Orion. It's where Tendi wanted to go. It's Pike at the Adashaki.
He's hanging out watching those dancers.
In the cage, they have him imagine that he's on Orion. I'm really interested with the Tendi storyline because we have heard so many references to the Orions. The Orions are in the cage. They're one of the first alien creatures we're introduced to is the quote-unquote Orion slave woman, the green slave woman. They go into them a little bit more on Enterprise. We see them a few times on Enterprise.
There's a TOS, right?
TOS has some Orion stuff. Enterprise has some. They're referenced a lot elsewhere. Deep Space Nine was often referencing the Orion Syndicate.
But
we didn't deal directly with them.
I was hearing about them Orion Syndicates.
Yeah, they're like the Honor Among Thieves episode with a, you know, O'Brien, where he was going undercover, he was dealing sort of tangentially with the Orion syndicates, people who were associated with the Orion syndicate. But it's been, and Esri Dax, later in Deep Space Nine in season 7, her mom is wrapped up in some Orion syndicate, or not her mom, but like her family. But anyway, it's going to be really cool to have an Orion as a main character. Particularly as a main character in Starfleet, since the Orions are so closely associated with crime and prostitution, sex work, I should say. So it's going to be cool to see where they take that story, because I'm sure, I really think that they've positioned Tendi, as I've mentioned before, as an audience surrogate, as she's the character who you can sort of see through her eyes. Because as a fan of Star Trek, you can enjoy and sympathize with her excitement for being on a Starfleet ship and not caring about these things that other people find inconvenient or obnoxious. Because from her perspective, this is amazing. And part of it is because she's a new ensign. Part of it, I think, is because she's coming from this culture where, you know, Starfleet is presumably quite different. Maybe she'll learn that it's not as different as she thinks.
And then the joke is that, you know, most of, you know, watch some kind of hospital show or something like that, and then I'm thinking of Scrubs for some reason. I don't know if this happened in there, but the show where they're
always thinking about Scrubs.
Always thinking about Scrubs. I also watched ER a lot. but when there's like the new person coming in, yeah, and they're all excited about, you know, changing the world and all this shit, and then by the end of the episode, they learn it's a lot of hard work, and it's like, oh, I don't know if I'm ready for this.
Bashir was like that a little bit.
Yeah. I was thinking that. I was thinking of that too.
Harry Kim, less so, but a little bit.
Yeah. So I don't know if he was thinking of a lot. And his character never got a chance to do too much thinking.
Yeah, Harry Kim didn't think too much.
Yeah. But
he played a lot of clarinet.
Yeah.
I mean, he didn't. He should have.
The old clarinet.
The old clarinet.
That's when the old clarinet.
That's when the old clarinet comes
tooting out. On the clarinet.
So
Harry Kim, 7 of 9.
But then the joke here is with her.
Two people, one clarinet.
Is that she's all into it and excited, and then she's getting into some shitty shit, and she's freaking out, and you're like, oh no, or she looks like she's freaking out, yeah. And then at the end, and she's all like, it's like
she loved it.
She got to hold a heart,
yeah,
which was a hilarious scene when she's pumping that heart, and the dude is like to save this dude who's dying, and she pumps it. He's like, yeah, oh,
did you see his eyes? His eyes bugged out every time she pumped it. They sort of what's the opposite of cross-eyed?
Wall-eyed.
So his eyes went wall-eyed. Every time she squeezed the heart, the eyes kind of pumped out a little and went wall-eyed. And he's like, oh, it is.
Yeah. She's like, I'm sorry. It's pretty funny having to save this guy, but basically put him in pain.
Well, I think it's a good point to mention that they have essentially reversed the normal order of the A and B plots, right? So in this episode, you have somebody get infected on the planet. They bring the infection back to the ship, to the Cerritos, and then that infection spreads. That's a trope in Star Trek. I mean, that in and of itself is a reference to the history of Star Trek, of that basic concept, right? But that's not the main story. That's the background story.
Yeah, that's a good point.
And that's really, I think, a good way in this pilot episode to stress, again, the perspective we're taking. We're not looking at the main story or the quote-unquote main people, the senior staff, as much. We're going to interact with them. We're going to see them. But they're not the main story. The main story are these lower-level folks.
And they still connect it with the because the guy's got the goo on him when they come back. And they're like, this guy's got the goo that can save us all. Like.
Yeah, protect that slime.
Like the A and the B storylines connect.
Yeah,
at that moment.
Exactly.
Yeah, because she
in the best Star Trek tradition, where at the end they sort of converge on each other.
Like at the end of the episode, we figured out some way to like save us by finding something like this. We found some slime from the planet. Like,
and Mariner, you know, her whole point was those people up on the bridge, they're, you know, a bunch of fuckers, and they'll use all of us to further themselves. Which is funny because in Star Trek in TNG, right? You know, or TOS or whatever. You hear about Captain Kirk, you hear about Spock, you know, you don't hear about the whole crew. It's like, you don't even, TOS especially, you kind of forget that there's a whole crew that behind.
They're faceless guys who are playing Italian mobsters on the set next door. The does he lose set literally next door? They just grab a couple of guys, take off their hats, and put red uniforms on them, and they stand there all lurking
on
around.
On TOS, you see more actual like enlisted crew.
They had more people. Like, they had more extras on TOS.
They had extras running in and out here, but you never really got a sense that that ship was alive in that sense. Well, like in TNG, you felt like they would, they were referenced like,
even though the hallways were always like weirdly empty.
Yeah, they were.
TNG.
Yeah.
I mean, it is a good point, though, that TOS did lack some of that life, even though it quite literally had more human bodies milling about.
I mean, yeoman.
Even on the bridge, there were all these, you know, more people than you, often there were more people than you would see on later shows.
Yeah, so, and so Mariner was basically stressing that point. It's like, they don't give a shit about us, so on and so forth, you know, and then that sort of reinforced by that point you were mentioning, Jesse, where they meet up and they're not like save him, they're just like save the slime.
Protect the slime.
We protect the slime by making sure he doesn't fall apart or something, you know,
like, and they sort of conflate him with the slime. They're pointing at him, and it's like protect that piece of slime. And we already see that Captain Freeman was happy to manipulate Boimler's sort of, you know, straight lacedness and adherence to the rules to try to get him to spy on and report on Mariner's actions. And that in and of itself was an interesting, very Star Trek-y philosophical conundrum, because she's his friend, presumably, and crewmate, you know. We don't know how close friends they are, but they definitely seem to have a friendly relationship. And it was interesting to see the arc of him initially being like, this is great, I have a mission from the captain, and slowly start to realize that it's not such an easy mission. Following the rules is not necessarily always going to be the way to be the ideal Starfleet officer, right? And Mariner is providing examples of that. And we learn by the end of the episode that she idolizes people like Kirk and Spock and Worf and et cetera. And these are all examples of Starfleet officers who found their success often by flouting the rules and going against orders in some cases. And I think that that is something that they may have touched upon previously in Star Trek, but I think that Mike McMahon has latched onto that as a potential arc between Boimler and Mariner, where they both need to rub off on each other, where Mariner needs to sort of chill out a little bit with regard to her whatever baggage she has that's causing her to act out, while at the same time, Boimler needs to understand that being a good Starfleet officer does not necessarily mean you follow all the codes exactly.
Yeah, even the captain told him, like, when he said he kept 5 journals, she's like, that's way too many.
She was like, that's excessive.
Yeah.
I thought that was a great line.
Yeah, I did too. I didn't see, after they did that reveal, I didn't see it coming. And when it happened, I was like, oh, why didn't I see that happening?
Yeah.
When we found out that the captain is the mother.
Captain Freeman is the mom.
Is the and mom, you know, and then, yeah. And then the guy
that makes it a good reveal, that you didn't see it.
Yeah, coming. I know. Or I could be slow, because I'm sure bunch of people...
No, you
know,
I don't. I thought it was...
It doesn't usually happen in Star Trek, so you're not expecting it.
Look,
yeah, so if the beats hit as they intended them for me, because the guy was like, when he said, honey, I didn't immediately think husband. I was like, is that her husband or her dad? I didn't think... And it's like, after he said husband, I was like, oh,
I got it before she said she's your daughter, too. I got the message before that line, but not until the middle of that conversation with the admiral.
Yeah, when he said daughter, I think that's when I got it.
Wow, okay.
Yeah, I didn't. I mean, you got it somewhere after he revealed that.
When she called him honey or something, when I realized, okay, they're married, and then I suddenly realized, okay, they're married and they're talking about this very particular ensign. That must mean there's a relationship there.
See, I was still
for this emotion to be present.
When you were thinking that, I was still trying to figure out if it was her husband or her dad, like the captain Freeman's husband or dad on the Admiral Freeman on the other line. Yeah. I didn't know which it was, and I was still thinking about that. And then when they said our child or our daughter or whatever,
I think she said she's your daughter too.
Yeah, and that's when I figured out first A, that she was her daughter, and then B, it's like, oh, he is her husband.
Yeah.
So that's I was a little slow, but. But it was within seconds.
But I don't think we don't get that guy's name, the admiral's name.
I'm assuming it's Freeman. Although who's to say?
Not necessarily.
Yeah,
not necessarily. Because Mariner's last name was Mariner married?
Yeah, that was. Yeah.
Like, why does she have a different last name?
His name could be Mariner.
No, that was fucked up of me. I shouldn't have assumed that his last name would be Freeman because hers was.
Well, I think it's a mark of, you know, you always talk about the marks of good mystery stories and the ideal mystery, like if you're reading a mystery novel, the ideal mystery novel is one where when you get to the end, you're surprised by the resolution, but it immediately makes sense based off of everything you read before. Mm-hmm. So in other words, you had all the clues there to potentially solve the mystery, but if you can solve it too easily, if you know who the killer is or whatever halfway through the book, that's not good. But if you find it out right about the same time the detective or whoever finds it out, then you get that rush. And I thought, yeah, no doubt some people might have guessed earlier on that there was this dynamic there, but I thought it was really skillfully plotted out.
When you write mysteries or stuff like that, when you have reveals or things like that, just mystery, I guess you could even just mystery novels or whatever, I wonder if it's effective or maybe more effective to reverse engineer it, you know, start at the end point and then try to to walk yourself backwards. I don't know. I would imagine that would be one methodology somebody would.
I think that works for mysteries. It might be trickier for histories.
Yeah. Wait. You start with what happened and then you analyze what happened. Isn't that how it works? Are you talking about history, you start with what happened and then you're talking about going backwards in time, like that anomaly in all good things.
My main focus was that the two words rhyme.
Yeah, that's sort of
it's like, but you were talking about like living in reverse time, like that anomaly in all good things. You're
he was
talking
just
about
sort of playing with the sound of words as opposed to the actual meaning of the words.
Yeah, you're giving me way too much credit here.
Well,
what's the deal with those hot bananas?
Yeah, man.
That was funny. Yeah.
Hot bananas.
Bananas hot.
And then later Rutherford, Sam Rutherford, somebody was, do the food replicators go down a lot? He's like, only when they get food.
Yeah. Exactly. Yeah, that was his date, who's a Trill.
Yeah.
She was a Trill.
Totally.
Yeah.
There's another reference.
Very attractive Trill lady.
Yeah, they all seem to be.
They said she was crazy hot or something.
Yeah, all the Trills seem to be.
I couldn't tell because she was a cartoon.
So, yeah, right.
Expand your mind, buddy. Rule 34.
Oh, no.
Okay, so I was on Reddit poking around, and one guy wrote this really wonderful comment, very thoughtful, insightful comment about Lower Decks, very appreciative, a great comment to open a conversation about the show. And then at the very end, the last sentence, he said, and by the way, does anybody know if there's any Rule 34 with Lower Decks yet?
And
all casual.
Yeah, I was like, dude,
I'm just a normal guy.
You've totally undercut. I mean, yeah, that is a normal guy thing to do, to be fair, but he's sort of undercut.
No,
you don't have to say it out loud. That's what I'm saying. He's like, I'm just having a normal conversation. This is a normal thing to ask.
You know? Have any cartoon sex porn?
Yeah, right.
And I haven't looked yet, but I have no doubt that there's...
It's like,
there's
context, dude, context.
Some Rule 34. Yeah, why not just go look for... And you know what? Honestly, when you say something like that, you don't need to... Come on, you don't need to say that. You look for it yourself.
Yeah.
You search Star Trek Lower Decks, you know, or Ensign Tendi Rule 34. You don't need to be asking that question publicly. There was a performative aspect...
You're just wasting oxygen.
Yeah, there was a performative aspect to that statement that creeped me out a little
bit. Mm-hmm.
Don't be creepy, guys. Mm-hmm. Or be less creepy. So women out there, you gotta give us some time and practice. We're not all going to be able to not be creepy, but as men, we should try to be less creepy.
What if you're just so creepy it's comical?
I don't think it...
Is that possible?
I think that's not comical to everybody.
Yeah. I think that's the best way to
put it. It's only comical in a certain sort of objective sense.
Yeah. I think that this... you know, Boimler, you know, jumping ahead a little bit, but, you know, they go down to the planet, and Boimler thinks that she's up to some shady shit. Mariner's up to some shady shit, selling weapons, and then he finds out she's just trying to help out these people. And it's another example of... We've seen our hero Star Trek characters do similar things many times in the past. And a lot of times it's not even like a debate or a question. It's not even like they don't even think in their head like, oh, am I breaking some rules? It's just like, no, it's the right thing to do. Give these people some fucking, you know, shovel and hoe, like it was in this case. Which complicated Boimler's whole reporting thing, because now he's thinking, wait a second, she's breaking the rule, but she's breaking the rule to try to help these people.
She was breaking rule 498 and 756.
Pig people.
Or they don't call them rules. They call them something else. They call them something 498 and 756.
I really enjoyed...
He was breaking 76 for pointing a phaser at her, which yeah. I don't know if it means you can't point a phaser at anyone or if another officer or a higher ranked officer. I bet 76 is not pointing phasers at a higher ranked officer.
76 trombones in the big parade.
Or not pointing your trombone at your commanding officer. Don't point your rusty trombone at your commanding officer.
don't point your bone at the officer. I think that Boimler getting naked is going to become a running gag because I get the impression he's such a sort of an anxiety ridden, straight laced person that he really feels degraded by being naked. And we've already seen in the preview at least one other instance where he's caught naked was in one of the previews ahead of the premiere.
Yeah.
We'll see where they go with that. But I would not be surprised if we see him multiple times stripped down because it's something he's not used to and clearly uncomfortable with.
You remember that Jane's Addiction song called "Been Caught Naked"? So like, been caught naked once when I was five. I mean, sure, you fam. It's just as simple as that.
I know that Jane's Addiction has two songs, and one of them is "Been Caught Stealing."
That's the one. except it's called "Been Caught Naked."
I like the idea that Jane's Addiction has two songs.
They only have two songs.
They only have two songs.
And then, like,
then they became porno for pyros.
Jane
isn't
that says,
how it works?
"Yeah."
Jane says,
and then porno for pyros has like one song.
They think the "We Make Great Pets" song is "We Make Great Pets."
Did you like the farmer people, the Gondolorians or Galadorians?
Like, they're like pig people, and they have like big spider cows or something.
Yeah,
big spider cows. I don't know why they kept that spider in a cage that it could tear out of. Could it only tear out of the door if it was left open? Then it could get the proper
leverage,
get some better leverage. Is that the whole deal with that?
Well, they had other ones in the field, so maybe that one was still being trained or something. Because we see later they have spiders just hanging out in the fields.
Yeah, but
yeah,
so that one
end,
was
yeah.
that one was penned in,
but it wasn't
for some reason.
But it wasn't penned in well. It was able to bust out.
I think it wasn't ready. It's like when you got to break a horse.
No, but I'm saying like if it's not ready, it shouldn't be able to break out of its cage.
No, I know
they built
a faulty cage. You've already explained it. It's once the door is open, you have the extra leverage to do it. That makes sense to me. You know?
Extra leverage to break it open. And
it was thirsty. It wanted to slurp.
Right. I think that that's a poor design, though, that something like that could cause it to fall to pieces.
I think it's a poor design that spider had effectively a prolapsed anus as a mouth.
Yeah.
But I did like that it was...
had a little turtle head when he was sucking on him.
I was very amused by that sequence. I was heartened by the idea, again, a very Miyazaki / Trek idea that the perceived... enemy turns out to in fact be not an enemy at all.
Yeah. He's an herbivore.
He's just slurping on.
He looked so happy in one part when he was slurping, and his eyes were closing.
Yeah,
he's like, It just like stayed on him for a minute.
And then
just
he gets
like,
tired and he's just like,
yeah. He looks so, it's like adorable. And the spider became really adorable.
And Boimler's is like, my bones.
We need him for the milk or something.
I did like, don't shoot it. That could spoil the milk.
Spoil the milk.
Later it's like, oh, I could spoil them.
Yeah. And she'll ask for some later.
Yeah.
Spider
milk. I would totally ask for some. I would totally drink that mix.
You
milk.
Know,
it tastes all webby.
I bet they couldn't build a good cage because the same reason they needed farmer's equipment. They just didn't have enough equipment. That's why they needed help so that spider wouldn't have broken free.
Like, why would you make first or second contact with somebody that hasn't even... like
learn to control
advanced
their
in a certain like agricultural sense. You're supposed to wait till they get to fucking warp drive.
Well, they had some cities and warp drive, and first contact is often centered around warp drive, but not always, because some people, whether they have warp drive or not, they still are aware of other peoples.
True. They can have astronomy and stuff.
Yeah. And yeah, so that's, you know, again, that's space, I think, the type of thing that we notice in an hour long episode or a full length episode. That would have been more nuanced and more.
They probably would have explained that there's some kind of tyrannical government and they're like being sort of exiled for, and so they don't have enough stuff to like you know, get by or something like that. But the government's really advanced.
Or they had technology and something happened, or you know.
Yeah, there was like the great EM electromagnetic. What's the EM?
Yeah, EM pulse.
EMP, impulse. That's the word.
Electromagnetic pulse.
Electromagnetic.
A side effect of a nuclear explosion.
I think that's what happened in Escape from, which was the first one? Escape from New York was the first one?
It doesn't matter.
It was the second one. The one that was not the...
I think they're kind of the same.
Escape from LA is the second one.
Yeah, it was. I think that was what the deal with Escape from LA is there was going to be an EMP that was going to knock out all of electricity. Yeah,
Escape from New York made sense because it was an island that you needed to escape.
Yeah, Manhattan. And this one you're escaping from the ocean or...
Like LA, the Escape from LA was a little less... cogent,
yeah,
shall we say.
Yeah.
Still but, worth watching.
But it was some kind of infinite, it was some kind of electromagnetic pulse that took out electricity for good, and it was like, never
take it right outside, take
something.
It right out back.
Or like at least a couple months, years, probably like 20 years.
But there were, there were a lot of the slurping scene with the prolapsed anus was fun. And this is one of those things where it's very difficult. We're not going to be able to just go down the list of all the jokes because there was
I think
just
we can
of,
hit on a few of them.
There was just a lot of, there were a lot of things going in there.
There's one key thing at the end, and I noticed this the first time I watched it. I was watching it without the sound. I was over at my in-laws' house, and I was reading the subtitles. But
did you ever watch it without subtitles?
Yeah, totally. Oh. I watched it a bunch, and then but they mentioned like Gary Mitchell.
Gary Mitchell. He's like, I could look it up.
He's like, I can look it up. And so then I read this article about how that was the funniest joke of the thing, and it had all these layers because like he actually can't look it up because it's been like removed. It's not that none of that like, officially
secret.
Happened.
Yeah.
Like
the Gary Mitchell stuff.
Yeah.
I see what you mean. In canon, is that what you say?
Yeah.
In
the history, like. Like
Kirk,
in the official Starfleet stuff. Yeah.
I was thinking in the real world, like in our world, we couldn't look it up. I was like, you meant in their world. Yeah.
And there's also this thing about how that's a very early Star Trek thing. And like, it's not that like the canon is still kind of funky. Mm-hmm. And like, you don't even have like a lot of the crew on that episode.
So she must know some shit if she knew about Gary Mitchell.
I'm sure I could look it up.
Not joking.
I'm not
Jesse.
Joking.
I'm not joking, Lee.
Not joking, Lee.
I'm
not joking, Lee.
I thought that at the end of the episode, when Captain Freeman is all chill, you know, everything's chill now. As we already discussed, Chief Medical Officer T'Ana rapidly created a gas to cure everybody, very Star Trek style.
There's just like zombie people.
All the zombie people get cured.
Oh, and when they cure all the zombie people, there's like some people are hanging around and there's goo left on them and there's a Vulcan and he's got goo on his face.
Yeah.
And it looks like a beard, like
Mirror Spock.
Like Mirror Spock.
Yeah.
There was one scene where like all the vampire people sort of ran at the screen, you know?
Yeah.
It was a little choppy, but it looked cool. I don't know.
It was similar to, there's an episode of Enterprise. I think it's in the third season when they encounter a Vulcan ship that has because they've gone into an area of space that messes with their Vulcan neurons or whatever, and it evoked a lot. It was very similar to that because that was in effect a Vulcan zombie attack.
Whoa.
In Enterprise. It's a cool episode actually, but the fact that Captain Freeman was all chill, right, was awesome because. It felt acute. Like in this episode, you feel like, in fact, her husband is even saying like, are you sure you're okay? And she's like, yeah, it's fine. But that's no different than any normal episode of Star Trek.
Right. It's kind of
stuff
that's
happens
what happens. All the
time. It all resets and Captain Picard and everybody's, they're all good at the end. I mean, Captain Kirk is always like half the time he's all like sitting in his chair and they're McCoy and Spock are behind him and they're all like chortling and laughing.
Yeah
Spock makes cracks some joke he didn't mean to crack.
Yeah. And they were all about to die and everything's fine. So I thought that was a really excellent reference to old school Star Trek. And it also emphasizes that this is going to be a largely episodic series. Now, that's not necessarily a surprise. I think it's what people expected, but that's what they are following the format of, you know, a 1990s style Trek show. As I mentioned before, the camera angles, the camera design, you know, like the shot design and things like that, the music, the style, the A and B story plots. But most importantly, they've wrapped up the story. Everything's concluded. I think the only difference is that they do appear to be focusing on some character growth and development. I think we will see.
Well, if the character was the A plot in this show and the B plot was really that kind of stuff, it can kind of really open the door to make it easier to make it episodic because it's B stuff anyway.
Precisely. Yeah. You know? I think it's a fairly ingenious approach to take to get back into the episodic storytelling while doing something different. So it'll probably follow the DS9 model a little bit more, where DS9, although it's lauded as one of the first sort of serialized shows, it really wasn't serialized in the modern sense until the last maybe 9 or 10 episodes.
It did, yeah. It changed over time, but yeah, it wasn't really until the end of the series, though.
What they did is they had episodic shows that were increasingly more interrelated, but they were still standalone stories.
Yeah.
It was more like there was like a seasonal arc kind of.
Precisely, yeah. And so I think we'll see a little bit more of that while getting that episodic flavor, which will get us cool guest stars, it'll get us interesting dynamic stories, and probably most importantly for the future, it's going to be easier, it seems, to hop in and out of episodes. Because I love the serialized Star Trek format. I'm in favor of that. That is a modern form of storytelling. But I also don't want it to be the only form of Star Trek, because there is a special thing about that episodic feel where you can just pop in and be like, oh yeah, let's just watch Things Past, or let's watch Day of the Dove, or you know, we'll just pick an episode and watch it and we can enjoy it without having to watch an entire season or an entire series.
Yeah.
You know, when we were talking about, when I mentioned Spock cracking a joke, it got me thinking about, like, Spock's a smart guy, right? He would know if he was saying.
No, he's dumb.
So, first of all, we know from Spock that he, like, when he says something, he knows what he's saying. He knows what it entails. But he's also doesn't really have humor. He's not supposed to crack jokes. I don't know. I'm assuming it's not logical or something, right? So when he's cracking jokes at the end of the episode, like what that one where, what was the last one he said we saw where it was like it was a moving experience? No, it wasn't that.
An accelerating.
Yeah. So he was cracking we know that he was cracking a joke, but the thing is does he not realize it? That was my assumption. But he's so smart, how could he not realize it? But on the other hand, the writers wouldn't have you like have him crack a joke, because that's not within character. So his character has two things going on. One, he's too smart to know what he's saying to not realize when he's saying some weird shit. But two, he doesn't say weird shit like that. So
that's in a sense that's a no true Scotsman fallacy, in the sense, because we know that Spock does crack jokes, and we know that the writers did have him crack jokes, and we know later when we expand on the Vulcan mythology, both in TOS and the TOS movies, but particularly in Enterprise, we know that a lot of what Vulcans assert to be true is not in fact totally true.
So you think he knew he was telling?
I think
jokes.
He 100% knew he was cracking jokes.
He's just super dry.
Yeah.
He's super fucking dry.
Maybe he's like dry. That dry. He's that dry.
Yeah. Which is, I'm a fan of dry sense of humor.
Well, I guess if it entertains him somehow, it's
And we see similar stuff with Data, right? Where Data is often played for laughs, even though he is himself, in theory, especially early on, not supposed to be able to understand what's funny, but he does things that people perceive as funny.
But he did that accidentally.
Initially, largely accidentally, but we do see him a few times cock his head a certain way, or, you know, there's a couple times where he'll say something
wink.
That's not a joke, not as jokey as Spock could get. But I think an analogy in this episode is Sam Rutherford, right? Because we know the least about him. You know, we saw him go on a date, so we learned a lot about his character, but we know the least about his background and his motivation. We know he's recently gotten this, I believe it was a Vulcan implant, but we don't know why.
He's an engineer with something on his face.
So why did he get that? Was he wounded? Was it like in Discovery, you know, when the ensign who was the pilot, you know, I forget her name at the moment, but, you know, she was injured in the pilot episodes, and then comes back later with the Cybermen.
Oh, yeah. Wait, what show?
On Discovery.
So I'm wondering
if this is an example of that, where he was wounded in some way. I presume we're going to learn more about that. Why does he have that? And then he has this issue where the reason he has this great date that goes very well, and it only falls apart at the end because he's more interested in this engineering problem that props.
Because there's like a level 2 diagnostic just waiting to be made.
And what's
some like bug smushing. He's got a like.
What's
fix
cool
some
about
bugs.
It? What's cool about it is initially it's almost very sitcom-y in that he focuses on this engineering problem and his date gets frustrated and is just like, oh, forget this, and wanders off. But then when in the follow-up, he's not upset about that. He's like, no, I didn't like her. He's like, I liked her. She was cool. She was smart. But she wasn't into what I'm into, right? She didn't get as excited about this as I did. And so I think that's going to be
one of the other girl was like, yeah, like,
Like, yeah, yeah. Tendi was like, all
what
about
was her
it.
Problem?
So I'm wondering if they're planning to have some sort of thing with between Tendi and him.
If not, like romantic, totally best buddies or something.
Yeah, but what we get is, I think this is an interesting divergence from what has traditionally been done in Trek, because almost all the Trek shows have sort of your one outsider character. Right. Sometimes they have multiple outsider characters, but there's often that one, whether it's Spock or Data or Phlox or arguably Neelix or Saru, I think is another potential example. That character who sort of embodies the outside perspective of humanity, and they can comment on humanity. They can reflect humanity, and it can be very useful as a storytelling device. Here it seems that they have Tendi kind of serving in that role for certain perspectives, but Rutherford, he's a human, but he has this change and he has this certain, you know, obsession with the engineering, so that they might be playing around with that as well with his character.
I like that scene. It was like they really put a lot in there, because the way they gave that sort of exposition about, you know, what he values and things like that, it was based upon another sort of narrative device that the audience never really cares about, right? You're running from some zombies and the door's fucked up for some reason. You don't care why it's fucked up. It's just fucked up. So they got to do their flim flam on it to open up the fucked up door, right?
Yeah.
To get inside the shit. And so in this case, it was that again. It's like, oh, the door's fucked up. What are we going to do? Let's bust it open. And they could have very well just gone on and we would have never thought about, I wouldn't have, but I think the intention would, it would be likely that you would have never thought about why that door was locked. You're just like, oh, it's a locked door. They got to get through the locked door so they can use the MacGuffin on the thing. And so in this way, they used it. They brought attention to it. They were about to leave from that door that was fucked up. I wasn't like, why did that door get fucked up? I didn't care, because that's not the focus. The focus is on the tension of the situation. And then when he breaks that by going back to the door, he's like, wait a minute, why didn't that door open? and so that was because it brought your attention to that sort of wacky thing that you don't think about. But then they also used that as a way to give exposition and sort of information about his character and what he's into. And then they played off of that to sort of show that they had something in common with Tendo.
I like that. Yeah, it's really, I think it's very interesting. And I think, you know, I've seen it maybe, I watched the episode 3 or 4 times. It's short, so you can watch it a bunch of times.
Totally.
But it's also dense. And I didn't really, I caught some of the character part, but you're right. I didn't really think of it in that sense of a play on the traditional type of thing that we'd see, which we are seeing a lot in this show. So we're seeing a lot of reversals and changing things around and looking at things from a different angle, which again, in this episode was done very well. It was a pilot episode, so it did have to be sort of extra dense. So, I don't know if they can keep that up. We'll see. I am optimistic, though, at this stage, both given the pedigree of the people working on the show and what's been demonstrated in the pilot, because I think they really did a really strong job of introducing these characters, introducing the overall vibe of the show. And so I'm excited to see, like Tarek, I'm excited to see where this goes and, what unfolds over the next 9 episodes.
Yeah. I was just thinking when you were talking about how at the end Captain Freeman was like, oh, it's no big deal. All this shit went down. They're like, no big deal. That actually happened with Rutherford, too. I think it was Tendi was asking him if the
Rutherford, too?
Rutherford as
shit.
Well. Motherfucker. he got me back from earlier.
I am Rutherford, too.
Tendi's all like, she's all like, did the rage virus affect you? It's funny they called it the rage virus. It's like such a thing to call it. Zombie. It's what you call zombies in a non-zombie world. But you still want them to be zombies. Anyways, she asked him if the thing fucked up his date, and he was like, no, that happens all the time. Which is what Captain Freeman is. So it was two references to this sort of idea that, you know, it's just like, no big thing.
She said something about how she was stuck in a sentient cave and it's a dark place that knows things.
Yeah, I thought that was good too.
Yeah, I like that one.
How about we go through some of the Easter eggs, right? Or are there any that you can think of off the top of your head? I know we've already referenced some of them. And again, let's not quibble about what's an Easter egg versus a reference versus just a part
right.
of
so,
whatever.
So, I mean, you can call me out on whatever, but
I do get annoyed when somebody's like, they had a Starfleet style ship. That's an Easter egg, right?
I thought... He's a little more specific.
Yeah.
So I thought, this is kind of a stretch, but one of them I noticed was when she had that all-nude Olympic training facility. You could just say that that's sort of like a like a throwaway gag or something, but I immediately thought of like, this is what the holosuites look like in DS9.
Yeah.
You know,
yeah.
It's just like, because they never show really what's going on.
And they definitely were like that on TNG. We just didn't
see
that.
Yeah, but you didn't get that. That wasn't implied in that.
The closest we get is Barclay, of course, but because he's a crazy person, he doesn't even just go straight to the sex.
We just see what like the upper officers do in the holodeck. Yeah. We don't see what like the
and we don't even see everything they do.
Right.
We see
true.
We see what they let us see.
We know that Geordi was wants to go on a date on a beach with a pirate playing.
Yeah. So there was a user on Reddit, because no reason to redo all this work that somebody else has conveniently done for us. A user called Antithesis, except like S-Y-S instead of I-S. But he's I don't know if it's a he. Could be a she. This user puts together lists of references and Easter eggs for pretty much.
Can't you tell by the way this person types that it's a guy or a girl?
I would, if I had to guess, I would guess the flavor of the text suggests a male.
Okay.
A white American male, approximately 30 to 40 years old.
Boo.
That would be my guess. But this person has been doing these lists of Easter eggs, references, etc., for Discovery and for Picard. And so they've been doing them. They looked like he's going to be doing them. They are going to be doing them for nice. For Lower nice. Decks. And it's a huge long list. We've already mentioned a lot of this stuff.
Yeah, all my shit's like kind of concepts, like the singing crystal. She's talking about she just got her head taken off singing crystal.
But that counts.
That counts. I immediately thought of the fucking I can't believe I'm forgetting that name too. The crystal that took over was going to take over the galaxy in TNG. That scientist,
the crystalline entity.
Crystalline entity.
Shit.
Yeah, I was thinking of the crystalline entity, but could have been any kind of crystal.
Yeah, no, that sort of stuff counts.
Was the one in
TNG.
It's Catastrophe, or what was it called? That's when Troy gets to be the... Was that the crystalline entity, or was...
No, that was a
when Riker goes down...
That was a quantum filament.
Fuck. Yeah. The crystalline entity was earlier, right?
Well, it's twice. It's once it's attacking the Omicron Theta, where Data was found, and then later there's the woman who it killed her son, so she like zaps it with some sound waves.
And she blames Data for something.
Yeah, and Laura's all hanging out with the crystalline entity. Yeah.
Riker was on the planet, and he was all befriending this woman, and then he went to a cave to hide, and he came out, and the whole place was...
That's
yeah,
on.
Yeah, I remember that.
She had that 1980s active ponytail.
Yeah.
She's like, I'm a scientist, and I have this super huge
That's
ponytail.
Right.
Yeah.
Crystalline entity.
But we see a number of aliens, right? So we see a Benzite. Those are the people that had the gas thing in front of their face. That we saw.
Oh, this person has some real Easter eggs.
Yeah, well, I saw the Benzite. I mean, everybody saw the Benzite. Come on, man. He was right behind Tendi.
Benzite. They've got some Benzites.
I think there was a Klingon recruit. We mentioned a lot of Vulcans, Bajoran. I mean, we see a lot of aliens in and amongst the crew. Trill, of course. So there's not Easter eggs per se, but they're using...
Cation.
The Cation, obviously.
Even though it looks more like some kind of like cartoon cat from like a Saturday morning cartoon than like the cat on the TAS.
Yeah, the TAS looked more realistic in a weird way.
Yeah, she was all bitching about having to write paperwork. I don't know if she was joking or not, but they were talking about
it. She wasn't joking. She was like,
she didn't want to become... cares about is science.
There was an Andorian in the bar, which was, you know, because we talked about in previous episodes that other than Enterprise, there hasn't been a lot of Andorian action since TOS. Enterprise did the most with the Andorians. When Mariner, at the beginning of the episode, in the teaser part of the episode, where she's got that all her contraband, there's a copy of the Ferengi Rules of Acquisition
in there.
Yeah, I didn't notice that either. That's one of the things that you have to have, those eagle eyes.
I love that part of DS9, the little they sprinkle that throughout the series.
This person has outlined, this Antithesis person has outlined in great detail all the Elkar's screen and, you know, the interfaces and stuff, and how accurate they are in terms of the geometry and the font and everything. They're very accurate to the TNG era computer interfaces.
Cool.
And the hallways and things like that. Even that shovel and hoe are similar to like in Captain's Holiday when Picard gets wrapped up with Vash and those crazy time aliens and
aliens.
And he's having to like dig. They're like having to dig a hole at one point in that episode. They're trying They're trying to find the artifact, and he's got a shovel that's similar to the shovel.
Wow.
You know, this sort of like shovel you like unscrew and put together. So that was similar. Of course, all the sounds, right? You know, just the sounds, the Star Trek sounds are all fucking there. The transporter sound, the holodeck sounds, all the computer chirps and bleeps and bloops are all there, which is awesome.
The bleeps and the heaps and the... What's that, Spaceballs?
The sweeps and the creeps.
Yeah.
The sweeps, the bleeps, and the creeps. The what? Only one man would dare give me the raspberry. Lone Star! Sounded funnier in my head.
Right now.
When will then be now? Yeah. So, I mean, there's a bunch of other, you know, things that you could call either Easter eggs or references, but we discussed most of them in terms of the architecture of the ship. But, you know, the last thing probably worth discussing is the opening sequence, which I think, Dan, you referenced that it's very similar to Voyager, which I agree. I think it really...
Did I say that?
One of you said it was similar to Voyager. Maybe Jesse said that.
I said it was similar to a lot of Star Trek. The beginning and the end.
I thought the music reminded me of like the Orville
I was going to say yes, absolutely. The music is Orville.
Yeah.
The opening is Voyager-esque.
It's like that TNG episode where they're going to some star to watch it like go supernova or something, and some other shit happens. I forget exactly what happens, but it's the same, that same kind of image of that like trail of stuff coming off of the,
And, but of course with the comical difference that they keep getting into goof-em-ups, like they're trying to observe these asteroids getting sucked into some black hole, and then they get sucked into the black hole.
I want to actually listen. I'm going to listen to the music for Galaxy Quest too, because I also wanted to say it was like that, but I didn't remember. It was more like, it sounded
more
like
triumphant.
But like the Orville is what the very first thing that came to mind.
But yeah, Orville came to mind, but other people have noted,
triumphant.
Other people have noted online that this show starts with a very, it's almost identical to the TNG sort of tones, and then sort of shifts into almost a TAS style variation before it gets into the more operatic Orville-ish kind of thing.
Yeah, I was actually thinking something similar, that it was there were parts of it that felt very Star Trek-y with the chorus of
It's not the most catchy tune yet, so we'll see. Maybe it'll grow on me. I don't have any problems with it. I think it's perfectly fine. I think it fits the show just fine, but it doesn't grab me, you know?
Yeah.
I argue I really like the Discovery theme music, for example.
Yeah, Discovery is really cool.
There's something about it. It's very exploratory and architectural, you know.
And it fits that time slot perfectly. It's like this just said what it needs to say. You know?
The Picard really music grew on me. It grew on me as I watched the show.
I was thinking. I need to compare the two because, like, I don't know. I'm still not sold on the Picard music, but it's been a while since I've listened to it. So. Yeah.
I mean, because the Picard music was...
I think
that
I like that. That's better than the Discovery music. The
Picard music was... I would still go Discovery in terms of just getting Discovery's my heart good. Going, but the Picard music was very pastoral and had this kind of vibe to it that again, as I watched the show, the music grew on me because it started to fit the show more. Because when you're first watching the show, you don't know what the show is about.
Right, exactly.
And that could be the case here.
Which is that's a different vibe than any other music. I know we've talked about that when we talked about Picard, but like the Picard music has a different feel to it than a lot of the other shows.
Clearly.
This is sort of purposely like, it kind of sounds, you know, vaguely like a lot of Star Trek stuff with a sort of goofy sort of...
A bit of a goofiness in there. And there's that weird part where they show up and see a bunch of Borg ships. You know, and a bunch of Romulans engaging with some Borg ships, and they turn around and just go away.
I actually did laugh, like, when she made the joke about Spock at the end, how Spock was dying and coming back to life. I mean, it seems like such an obvious joke, but like the way she delivered it,
the very last line of the episode is when she said, "What about Deanna Troi? She started out with a jumpsuit and then
she was like, she had a body."
Yeah, all right. And the magnetic boots. I just, for some reason, when they were on like the ship walking with their magnetic boots, I liked how it sped up like and went like Yeah. Thump. Like, it was like, it looks like they're wearing magnetic boots. I just thought that was a you know.
And it's a callback to, I think most clearly to First Contact. Yeah. Because they have a line about, you know, let's go for a walk, which is like in First Contact. But they also have the magnetic boots in Star Trek VI. They have them in Discovery. The whole walking around on the ship thing they do, you know, it's done elsewhere. So it's a reference in that sense. But it also was, you know, it's showing the outside of the ship a little, showing what these people are capable of. Mm-hmm. And that whole thing with their date, they were, these are professionals. Right, these are Starfleet people. They were making the point that nobody we saw was incompetent, and I think some people were afraid of that. They were afraid that this is going to be a ship full of incompetent people, and it's going to be comically bad, you know, because it's going to suggest that Starfleet has dumb people in it. Mm-hmm. I do think they're making the point. No, anybody who's in Starfleet is some minimum level of competence. They might not all be, you know, galaxy-saving heroes, but they're competent people. Mm. Boimler seems competent. Mariner seems competent. Mariner's problems isn't with her skill set. It's with her attitude, right? At least from the perspective of her mom/captain. And Boimler clearly is very interested in following all the, you know, he's sort of a Wesley type in some ways, an older version of Wesley. And Sam Rutherford and Tendi, they both do their jobs very well, it seems. Whatever they're doing, it might be goofy, you know, that they're having to do this, that, or the other thing, but they're doing it well, which I think is going to be important that they keep that up, because I do agree that if they had gone the route of these are some, you know, morons, they're not in the lower decks because they're stupid. They're in the lower decks because they're young, inexperienced ensigns for the most part, and they've got to work their way up through the ranks. And in the process, we're going to learn more as an audience about the what we may have assumed before, but we'll get those stories front and center that these people are necessary. These are not expendable people. Unlike TOS, where it seemed like you could expend just about any motherfucker on the ship if they weren't, you know, Spock, Bones, or McCoy.
Yeah, I mean, this specifically focuses on the lower decks, like the ones that you don't think about, which in the spirit of the episode of TNG. Well,
I watched this with my kids, and they really enjoyed it. They were very engaged by it, which was cool because they see me watch Star Trek all the time, and sometimes they hang out and linger and watch a little bit. They're very familiar with it in sort of an by osmosis fashion. But in this case, they sat down, they watched it, they engaged with the story. Atom was all excited because when he saw Ransom get bit by the bug, he was like, oh, I bet he's going to go back to the ship and something bad's going to happen because he got bit by that bug.
He was right.
And yeah. I mean, I was very proud of him for being nine years old and being able to understand the story structure. Now, other people would say, like, oh, it's because it's bad writing. No, it's not. That was the B plot. The point was to get it going quick. But the key thing was that, you know, when my son was towards the end of the episode, he was saying, why are they taking all the credit for saving the ship? They said it was because of the as he put it, he said, the girl, if she hadn't broken the rules to go help those pig farmer people, like, then Boimler wouldn't have chased after her. He wouldn't have gotten the slime from the creature. He was basically pointing out that their personality traits, positive or negative, are what ultimately led to the ship being saved. And I think that even accentuates in some ways that Captain Freeman being like, oh yeah, it's no big deal. It casts it in a slightly different light, because they all could have been fucked if it hadn't been for this series of events that had happened on the planet.
And like what we were saying before about how it wasn't save Boimler, it was like save the slime, right?
Save
and
the
this
slime.
Was right after Mariner was telling him they don't give it up, they just care about furthering their own careers. Which was, I was surprised why the Doctor didn't want to write a paper to like show the world, because that would further her career, but maybe she's a true scientist.
Well, maybe she's already there. She's where she wants to be.
Yeah, that's right. She doesn't need to do that kind of grunt work anymore. I liked when she was talking about, when Mariner was talking about being in that Klingon prison fighting a Yeti for her shoes. Mm-hmm. He was just being a dick. That kind of humor is like, I don't know. I'm sure a lot of people cringed at that something. But I thought it was great. People who think cringe at the other stuff that I think is funny. Not saying my humor is better than yours.
Yes, he is.
Just saying
probably.
To each their own.
It might be.
To each their own.
Dan is an expert knight of the humor.
He is.
Humor.
All right. So let's end the podcast now.
That's it. That's the end. Bye.
It was a good episode.
Yeah.
Next week, we're going to talk about the second episode, which is called Envoy. So next week, we'll talk about Envoy, continuing our coverage of Lower Decks.
Lower Decks.
So far, so good. Good start. And we'll see. We'll see where they take things. And it's new Star Trek, which is fun. So we look forward to following up. Send in your comments, what you thought about this episode. When you get to watch the next episode, send in comments what you thought about that. And we look forward.
Don't be a hater.
Yeah, we look forward to continuing this this fun discussion of this new cartoon animated Star Trek. So if you want to reach us, how, Dan, how could they do it?
Feedback at itsgotstartrek.com.
Excellent.
That's Did you say feedback?
No.
It was the cleanest read Dan has ever given of the email. Earlier today, Dan was like trying to type in like our email and he typed in, what'd you type in? You typed in like itsgotstartrek@feedback.com.
Yeah, yeah. I was typing that in on my phone.
Like, I'm like, on the podcast.
I was like, my phone keyboard. I got through it. I'm like, wait a minute. That's not right.
All right. Feedback at itsgotstartrek.com. That's the email. Itsgotstartrek.com is the website.
Ooh.
So, what about social media?
At
Instagram. I don't know.
Jesse's not involved in any of the social media stuff. So,
fine.
All those people.
You always ask me like every other episode of the podcast.
Yeah, I thought
Jesse, where is it?
And but like, I don't know. I gave you an alley oop. You were supposed to take my oop.
Yeah,
I gave you an
alley. You got an oop.
I gave you an at.
And it's got Star Trek?
Totally.
I thought that was obvious.
Yeah, but well, I mean, it wasn't obvious enough for you to say.
People at home, don't add don't add a question mark to the end of it. It's just it's got Star Trek. No question mark. At it's got Star Trek on Instagram, Twitter, and TikTok is apparently now banned, but we weren't on it to begin with.
Mm-hmm. Is he just trying to ban that because they messed up his rally using TikTok?
Yeah,
is that all that is?
That seems to be the case. Yeah, okay. The president is fighting with a bunch of teenagers. But Instagram, Twitter at It's Got Star Trek, and also It's Got Star Trek on Facebook, which is a great spot to leave comments and all that other good stuff. And otherwise, I think that does it tonight for me. My name is Patrick.
I'm Dan.
I am Jesse.
And that's Jesse. And so
is Jesse.
We'll be right back at it, right back in the saddle again next week.
You won't even know we were gone. We'll be back in a flash.
Have a good one. Bye-bye.
What? Oh, man, I would kill to work on the deflector dish. Most of my day is spent repairing food replicators.
They really break that often?
Only when you get food in them.